1 Samuel. Chapter 22. Of course, we've seen quite a bit up to this point. We've seen David driven out of Israel. In the last chapter, he went to the land of Nob, to Ahimelech, the high priest, where he ate bread and found the sword of Goliath. And he left there, interestingly enough, and went to Gath, Goliath's hometown, strolling into town with Goliath's sword. That had to be seen as an act of arrogance by the people of Gath. There's just no way that it wasn't. And you know, David wasn't thinking right at this point. He was living life out of fear. Well, they ultimately laid hands on him and he faked being out of his mind. He acted as though he was insane. The chapter effectively ends with the king saying, "Sell crazy somewhere else, we're all stocked up here." We assume then that Achish, the king of Gath, sent David away, or at least allowed him to go. But he said he had enough madmen in his hometown, in his empire, that he just didn't need one more. So David is allowed to leave. So we begin in chapter 22, verse 1. It says, David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him, and everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. And he became commander over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me." And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah." So David departed and went to the forest of Hereth. So David departed from there. That is, he departed from Gath. And again, we just assume that Achish allowed him to leave, thinking that he was insane. He didn't need one more madman there. But it does say that he escaped. He departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. I don't think it means that he escaped from Gath, though, you know, a conversation over coffee may convince me of that. But I think he is still escaping from Saul, who is trying to murder him. I believe he escaped and he is hiding, not from the king of Gath. He was hiding ultimately here from Saul. At least that's the way that it reads to me. You know, you can't help but see the protective providence of God in the life of David here. David was not well to be so fearful and escape and ultimately go into a place that he probably had no reason to be there, wearing their champion's sword. We can't think that's a high point in David's life. But nonetheless, God is still providentially protecting David through this. God has a purpose for David. David is going to be king. And it may not be David's highest point. That doesn't change the fact that God is still sovereign and God is still protecting him. So we ought to at least be able to see that. He escapes to the cave of Adullam. This is what is going to be referred to later in this same passage as the stronghold. Same thing. This was a very protective place for David to be. It actually wasn't just a cave like we sometimes think of a cave. It was a system of caves where it was easy to escape and hide out from somebody. If somebody were to attack you in this one cave, then you could leave and find your way out another direction. It was a cave system, and again, will be referred to as the stronghold. It's going to work for protection for David during this time. Look to the 57th Psalm. There's something happening to David at this time that I think we need to consider. You'll notice, though it's not inspired, there is a note just before this that says, "Let your glory be over all the earth." That's how the translators named the psalm. And then they have this note, "To the choir master, according to Do Not Destroy, a mictum of David when he fled from Saul in the cave." So this was written when David is right where we see him at in this chapter. We don't often connect the Psalms to the passages like we need to. It does matter. Listen to what this says. "Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by." What do you think David's fearful state that ultimately drove him out of Israel, drove him into Gath, where he has to act like he's insane? Ultimately, he's chased out of Gath into the cave system of Adullam. What does God use that for in David's life? I think he uses that to bring him to this point right here that we see in Psalm 57. God uses this time of David's life to draw him back to not trusting Goliath's sword, but to trusting in Him as the deliverer. "Be merciful to me," not the king of Gath, not Saul. "Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me in you," not in the sword of Goliath that he had toted into Gath, "but in you shall my soul take refuge." He's going to be protected not in the foreign enemies of Israel, but in the shadow of God's wings he is going to take refuge. How long? Well, as long as is necessary, till the storms of destruction pass by. We see a better David coming out at this point once he's fled here. He says in verse 2, "I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills His purpose for me." Look, death was right at his doorstep, he thought. But what he needed to remember was God had promised him that he'd be king. There's nothing Saul can do to change that. God is sovereign over this. We see David now beginning to really lay hold of the promises of God while he's in this cave system. Look at the 142nd Psalm. By the way, I would urge you to go and read that psalm as well as this one here. The 142nd Psalm has a title put in there by the translators, "You Are My Refuge." But you notice the note here, it says, "A Maskil of David when he was in the cave." Same time. Both these psalms were written around that time. Listen to what he says. "With my voice I cry out to the Lord." He's at the point, he doesn't have anybody else to cry out to. I mean, Jonathan can't help him. His wife, Saul's daughter, can't help him anymore. Saul is his enemy. He fled out to Gath. He couldn't be helped there. He's at the point where he's got one last place to depend. God. You know, God often uses or the things that happen to us in life, our circumstances, He often brings those about so that we will ultimately latch on to Him. We ought to trust in God at the very beginning. But if David didn't, we're just not always going to. But he says, "With my voice I cry out to the Lord. With my voice I plead for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before Him. I tell my trouble before Him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see. There is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No one cares for my soul. I'm out of places to escape, God. You are going to have to take over." Well, God had been in charge of this the entire time. He says, "I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge." That's very interesting. When David is sitting in this cave system, David is sitting in the stronghold, so to speak. And yet he doesn't say the stronghold is his refuge. He says, "God is my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. We see a different David as you turn back over to 1 Samuel 22. We see a different David coming to the scene than we've seen in the last couple of the chapters. Last couple of chapters, David's been fearful. David's fled. David didn't know what to do. He went to the priest. He unlike when he's on the field with Goliath and he says, I don't need the king's armor. This is God's battle. God will handle this. Just give me a sling and 5 stones and we'll make this thing happen. Different David in the last chapter, right? He asked for a weapon. But once he is free from Gath and he's in the stronghold, he's in that cave system of Adullam, he comes to understand God is ultimately going to protect him and God is going to fulfill his promises to him. So I make that point to you with those Psalms to show you, you're going to see a different David in this particular section. So it says right here in 1 Samuel 22, David escaped from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. Whatever frustration his brothers had when he was on the battlefield, you know, his older brother sort of thought David was showing out a little bit when he wanted to fight Goliath. That seems to have passed. Now, it could have passed because David wasn't in cahoots with Saul, and that meant danger for them. So they may have sort of been forced into going to David at this time. I don't know. But they do at least go to him to flee for safety. Those that had gotten on the wrong side of Saul fled to David. It wasn't just David's family. When his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him and everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. We aren't told a lot of the political atrocities of Saul, but there were some, without question. Jonathan had already told us back in chapter 14, my father has troubled the land, if you'll recall that. There was more going on than we have written. We really just have the spiritual battle of Saul and ultimately his downfall in this book. But when you have spiritual problems the way Saul had spiritual problems, your political reign is not going to be good. I mean, the scripture says when the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when the wicked rule, the people groan. And a wicked man is on the throne, Saul, and the people are groaning. And they are escaping to David. Again, I don't know what all happened, but apparently taxes are going up, debt is going up, and people are beginning to suffer as a result. Ultimately, these are the people who will form the nucleus of David's future kingdom here. This ragtag group. These people who escaped from Saul are beginning to form those who are going to support David and ultimately will grow in his kingdom. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Jesus had a similar group. He had a group that was rejected by the world. They were ignorant. They were unlearned men. They weren't the scholars of the day. They weren't the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. They were fishermen or perhaps even a tax collector, a enemy of the nation of Israel, or perhaps a zealot, a terrorist of the day. I mean, Jesus had a ragtag group, much like David has here. Ultimately, both of them will overcome their enemies, we know, albeit in different ways. David moves from the stronghold and goes to see the king of Moab. The king of Moab apparently receives him, and we don't exactly know why. I mean, they were the enemy of Israel at this time. But there's a couple reasons that we could at least think of maybe why he was received. Number one, David was a refugee that had fled from Israel. So maybe he sees David as somebody who would help him at this point. Or maybe because David's great-grandmother was from Moab. Who? How do you know that? Well, her name is Ruth. Ruth is David's great-grandmother, and she was a Moabitess. So maybe because David had a lady from Moab in his genealogy, he was received by the king of Moab. You mean to tell me God may have sovereignly been working that out before David was ever even born? Sure I do. That's what God does. God worked things out thousands of years ago for our good right here. It shouldn't shock us that God would have worked that out for David. And David calls his, or asks the Moab, the king of Moab to protect his mother and father. He says, please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me. First time we're introduced to his mother here, we're not going to get a whole lot about her, but apparently they're elderly at this time. They're unable to take care of themselves. And he, knowing that he is the enemy of Saul, and that Saul probably isn't going to keep that promise that he made on the field there when he said, whoever fights Goliath and kills Goliath, I will protect his family and they will be free from taxes. David says, you know, he's probably not going to continue to hold his end of the bargain there since I'm now an enemy of Israel. He asks them to be kept there with the king of Moab. But the key point here is not that he allowed his parents to stay here with the king of Moab. Don't get caught up in that. Get the rest of the sentence. Please let my father and my mother stay with you, listen, till I know what God will do for me. Different David. Not the same David we saw flee. This is the David that we just read about in the Psalms. The David who is now trusting in God. He knows God's going to do something. He just didn't know exactly what yet, but he knows God is going to work. David's real goal here is, well, I mean, he does care for his parents. I don't mean to say that he doesn't, but his real goal is he's looking for the will of God in his life. He wants to find out what that is. Again, a renewed interest in spiritual things. As more proof of David's spiritual revival, if you want to call it that, God sends a prophet to him. Notice, verse 5. Then the prophet Gad said to David, do not remain in a stronghold. Depart and go to the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Now look, prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet came to Israel. And they persecuted and killed prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet. Not David. God sends a prophet to him, says, don't stay in the stronghold, return to Judah. David up and goes. David is a faithful man. And David has a renewed interest in spiritual things. Look, it was fearful David that fled Israel. But it's faithful David who hears the words of the prophet and does what God tells him to and returns. Verse 6. Now Saul heard that David was discovered, the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Interesting passage. Saul clearly is still angry with David and anybody that he thinks may have any connection with David. I don't know how he gets word of where David and his men are, but it is interesting that when you contrast Saul and David here, you get complete opposites. I mean, you've got David who has this renewed interest in spiritual things, and you've got Saul hardened further in unbelief and intolerance for God's will. Just completely different men. Saul's hatred of righteous people has made them outcasts. I mean, the righteous in the land were with David. They were outcasts. And even Saul's men, though they're following him, are more righteous than him. We'll see that a little bit later. This sounds a whole lot like the Saul that we read of back in chapter 19. When it says in verse 8, there was a war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul, and he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. I mean, you can just picture a man sitting in a dark room, tapping his foot with his spear in his hand. I mean, this is a madman. Something's off here. It's just the same image you would think of someone with a spiritual problem. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand. I mean, he was just ready to hurl it at anybody. And ultimately, back in chapter 19, he hurled it at David, we know. And we know that he's tried to kill his own son, Jonathan, by this point. Saul's anger and hatred for David had just made him completely paranoid of anybody. Notice what he says. Saul said to his servants, verse 7, who stood about him, hear now, people of Benjamin. By the way, whose family is this? Saul's. This is Saul's tribe. This is Saul's kinsmen. How did he feel about the rest of the tribes? I mean, this is his own people that he's talking to here. Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Now, these aren't the people who fled to David. These are the people who are still with Saul. And yet, this hatred for David had led him to think that everybody around him was ultimately betraying him and was ready to flee to David. We're given no hint that these people were planning to do that. But again, Saul is the epitome of a madman, having his own pity party at this point. All of you have conspired against me. No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. No one of you is sorry for me. No one discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. He's just pitying himself. Nobody wants to play with me anymore. He's like a kid. But it's worse than that because he's in power. One of the worst things that can ever happen is for an immature human being to come to power. Saul is spiritually depraved and childish, but he's got power. And that makes him dangerous. We'll see just how dangerous as we work through this chapter. He's obviously still mad at Jonathan, by the way. Jonathan's going to die on the battlefield with his daddy later in this book. Jonathan is a faithful son. I don't know how in the world Jonathan juggled being faithful to David, who was the rightful king, and yet he remained a faithful son at the same time. Here his father's talking about him. Treacherous. Jonathan has done nothing wrong. Jonathan has only protected an innocent man. And he has expressed that to his father. He hasn't hidden it from him. He's talked to his father about that. Now, most people who find themselves in a predicament where they are working for somebody who's a little paranoid and a little crazy, they sort of begin to look for a way out, don't they? I've taken this job. I'm working for a fruitcake. How can I get out of here? But there's always that one person who sees an opportunity. Enter Doeg, the Edomite. It says in verse 9, then Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, he answered and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. That's everything we just studied about in the last chapter last week. Ahimelech, you know, gives him the bread of the presence. We've discussed all of that. I don't have time to go into all of that, but if you'd like to hear it, it's recorded. But he gave him the bread of the presence and he gave him Goliath's sword. Now, according to the Mosaic law, the evidence of one person is not enough, is it? It had to be two or three witnesses. Deuteronomy 17 says, on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. That's reasonable. God is a reasonable God. Deuteronomy 19 says, a single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense he has committed. That's clear. That's plain. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall a charge be established. Well, we've got one man standing up and saying, I saw this happen, and the priests, they're not for you, Saul. They're helping David. They gave him provision. They gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Saul should have sought out another witness by the law. He had to. I mean, one of the things that the king had to do was write the law from start to finish when he took office. But Saul is not a spiritual man worrying about what the law of Moses has to say. He's a depraved man who is just interested in getting even. So he doesn't ask for another witness. Verse 11. Then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob, and all them came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king, and who among all your servants is so faithful as David? Uh-oh, this ain't going to go well. Who among all your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little. The king said, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. And the king said to the guard who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David. And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, you turn and strike the priest. And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priest. And he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod, and Nob, the city of the priest, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword. So Saul calls these priests to himself, and you know, we know what he had in mind when we began to read this. It bears out in the passage that his intent was to murder these people who he thought were his enemies, who had conspired with David. And Saul just blatantly accuses the priest of rebellion for doing the job God had told him to do. Priest had just been a priest. He was just following the law. I mean, it's his duty to help people. It's his duty to be merciful. It's his duty to be faithful to leaders who he saw David to be. And it's his duty to inquire of God for people. That's the duty of the priest. Saul is angry with the priest for doing what God had instructed the priesthood to do. Well, that's because Saul is in a very depraved state. I mean, who is he really angry with? Is he angry really with the priesthood, or is he angry with the ones that the priesthood are serving? He's angry with God. We have no idea really what all Ahimelech knew, but just taking him at his word, I don't think he knew anything about this whole problem between David and Saul. I mean, why would he? David lied to him about it. David said, I'm on a special meeting. I mean, a special mission from the king, and I left so quickly that I forgot my sword. Which doesn't make sense, but that's what David said, and David was respectable. I mean, that's what he even says to the king when Saul accuses them of rebellion. He says in verse 14, who among all your servants is so faithful of David? I feel like just in my own mind, that's where Saul stopped listening to the priest right there. Faithful as David? Well, clearly you've got a problem. But he goes on. That's not all he says. Who among your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law? Look, he is your son-in-law. I'm not rebelling against you. He's your family. He says he's also captain over your bodyguard. I'm helping out your bodyguard by helping David out. And not only that, Saul, he's honored in your house. He goes on and says, is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No, he prayed for David before. I think we can assume he probably prayed for Saul before. That was his duty as a priest. And he goes on and urges Saul not to do the wickedness that he knew Saul wanted to do. I mean, I think he knew at this point this wasn't going to end well. He says, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of this, much or little. He said, I didn't know about this argument that y'all got in. I didn't know that he had fled. I'm innocent in this whole thing. Don't do it. He's asking for Saul to think rationally. Well, Saul's not thinking rationally. He's irrational. He's a madman. You can't reason with an evil person. And it just doesn't work. It's in one ear and out the other. I mean, Saul responds by saying, you shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. He didn't even try to reason with him. That's why I say, I think he lost him at, you know, who is so faithful as David? He just sort of lost him there. Saul said, you're going to die. I think this is probably Saul's true low point, though you could probably make the argument that it's a little bit later. I mean, he reminds me in a sense of Belshazzar in Daniel 5 when he had all the utensils from the temple brought in and they drank wine from the utensils that God had told them to make for temple worship, for true worship. And then they praise the gods of silver and gold. They are so opposed to God there that God takes the kingdom from him that night. That reminds me somewhat of Saul's view of God's people here. Saul isn't worried about who he's about to murder. It'd be one thing if he was about to murder a friend of David's, just some random person, even Jonathan, but here he's murdering the priesthood. And that seems to me to be just one step further than a normal murder, if you want to call it that. So he tells his guards, verse 17, the king said to the guard who stood by him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord because their hand is with David. They did not disclose it to me that he had fled. There's still a little bit of honor for the priesthood in Israel. These are Saul's guards and Saul's followers. I don't know how honorable you could really make them out to be, but they had a little bit of respect for the priesthood. They wouldn't do it. It says the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Well, Doeg's still there. Then the king said to Doeg, you would think now Saul would be, it would be registering with Saul. Why? I guess that is a big thing I'm asking them to do, to kill the priests. But it doesn't. He's irrational. He looks at Doeg, he said, you turn and strike the priest. And Doeg the, what? Edomite. We already knew he was an Edomite before this point, but specifically the writer puts it there. Well, he's a descendant of Esau. He didn't care about the law of Moses. He didn't care if there was a second or third witness. He didn't care about the priesthood. Saul actually grabs effectively a pagan and has him kill the priests. It's not a good time for Saul. Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priest, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, after he killed them, he went to Nob, the city of the priest, and he put it to the sword. He killed man, woman, child, infant, ox, donkey, sheep. He put to the sword. He slaughtered everything. Everything. And this is what Saul told him to do. Chantry writes this. Years earlier, Saul had not been able to bring himself to slay all the Amalekites and their cattle. He was instructed to go slay them. He continues, he says, now he's obliterated both priesthood and a town. The people he was supposed to be protecting. So God told him to go, you know, kill everything in the Amalekite camp, and he didn't. He couldn't. Here, he kills the priesthood and everybody connected with the priesthood and even all of their animals. You think that he would at least keep the animals. I mean, they eat good, right? So angry that he slaughters even the animals there. I mean, we see Doeg doing this, but he's doing it at the mouth of Saul. Saul told him to do this. This is one of the last depictions of Saul's heart we are going to get in this book. Only one more time are we going to get a glimpse into the heart of Saul. And that's in chapter 28, when we will see in his depravity that he visits a medium. And then he's going to die in disgrace. Saul is not the picture of a child of God. Saul is the picture of one who did not endure. He never truly believed. Verse 20. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me and do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me, you shall be in safekeeping. That's an encouraging passage of Scripture. Turn back to chapter 2 of this book. I want to make a point here. God is speaking to Eli. He says in verse 30, therefore, the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. You remember Hophni and Phinehas, the wicked sons of Eli? They had desecrated the priesthood. And God is pronouncing judgment here on Eli and his family. It says in verse 31, behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house so that there will not be an old man in your house. You know what God did through Saul? He fulfilled this. He fulfilled this promise in chapter 22 through a wicked man. You say, well, doesn't that make Saul a good guy? No, it doesn't make Saul a good guy at all. I mean, God used Pharaoh, you know, a wicked man. God does that. He goes on to say here in chapter 2, then in your distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there will not be an old man in your house forever. Listen to this, verse 33. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar. So he's going to slay the entire house of Eli except how many? One. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared for what purpose? To weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. What happens in chapter 22? All the house of Eli dies by the sword of men. How many escape? One. And he escapes to David. Isn't that amazing? Now, in a sense, God ordained this and brought this to pass. And we have no question about that. We see that clearly on Scripture. Yet, that still doesn't ease David's guilt of fearfully fleeing over there and going through this. David still, from a human standpoint, did bring this about by his own weakness. And I'm sure that it caused David problems because he says, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your house. I know it hurt David that happened. But he tells the priest to stay with him and he'll protect him. And we see this priest stay with David on the promise that he would be protected temporarily. His life would be protected by David. How did David know that? Well, David had latched on to the promises of God by this point. He knew he was going to be king. We didn't see that David before. You remember the Psalms that we read? He's trusting in God now. The promises of God are true, and David saw that. Folks, you can't help but think of Jesus when you read this. I mean, this king, you know, this priest flees to David, and David protects him physically. But those that flee to the Lord Jesus Christ in faith, he protects spiritually, eternally. Can't help but see that. Look, in this chapter, we see a spiritual awakening in David, and it follows a spiritual decline. David had spiritual decline. We're going to have spiritual declines in our life. We are not David. I don't mean to elevate David above human. He was a human being. But we needn't think that we are above David. We're going to have declines, but look, seek to recover well. David did. He had a decline, but afterwards he trusted in the Lord. He threw all of his confidence in the Lord. The Lord was his refuge. When you have a season of decline, recover well. Trust in God. God uses those times to grow us, just like he did with David. Stand with me, if you will. Drake, will you dismiss us, sir?